Hey, Lark, I just got the best new earbuds. They're called Et from Studio.com. They're so comfortable and weatherproof.
Hey, I got a pair too. They're my first earbuds and they're fantastic. They come in their own little wireless charger case with a USB cord.
You can charge them anywhere and play them for up to 6 hours on a single charge. And I can use them with my iPhone, my laptop, or even my iPad Pro.
They're Bluetooth and noise canceling, and the built-in mic is great for making phone calls.
And they're pink. I just love them. Did I mention they're pink?
They come in several colors, actually. Anyone can get them on Studio.com. Just use the code KUDZU for 15% off. KUDZU.
Hi, y'all, and welcome to Kudzu Killers, Homicide, and Sweet Tea, where we'd like to share gothic tales of Southern-style murder.
I'm Lark, and that other voice you hear is Kim. Each week, we take turns telling you the gruesome details of serial killers, spree killers, and just plain old mean people that we find interesting, and we hope you do, too. Sometimes quirky and weird, but always respectful.
So sit back, grab your glass of iced tea, relax, and let us take you step by step through our story. And feel free to shoot us a comment on a specific episode on our blog at kudzukillerspodcast.blogspot.com.
Now, let's get on with the show.
Everybody, thanks for coming back to listen to another episode of Kudzu Killers. Hope you had a chance to listen to our last episode, our 50th, about Jack the Ripper, the guy who got us both interested in true crime.
Woohoo!
So how was your weekend, Lark?
My weekend was really very fun.
Good.
It was cold and wet and rainy, so for the first time, Jody and I went and had pho and hot pots, and it was so silly and fun that we got to enjoy that.
Yeah, those are pretty, that's pretty fun.
It was so silly that we were giggling and really enjoyed it and playing with your food and eating soup on a rainy night.
We didn't do much. We went to a board game sale because we're, you know, board gamers. Mm-hmm. And then we got the Christmas tree up and decorated and had somebody hang lights on the house. And so we're ready for it. Another holiday without our family or just the three of us.
Oh.
Which is hard, I'm sure, for everybody.
I know. But there will be good times again, no doubt.
Yeah, hopefully soon.
No doubt. And in the meantime, there's always murder.
That's right. Plenty of murder.
Murder. So what's our story today, man?
Well, today we're going to go back to 1990, which it turns out was one of the most violent years here in Dallas. They were having two murders a day.
Oh my God, I was there at that time.
Uh-huh. Everybody down in Oak Cliff was talking about a serial killer who had a really creepy calling card. He liked to pick up prostitutes and take them to his favorite spot. Then he would kill them, and that's not the creepy part.
Uh-oh. What was it?
After he killed them, he'd cut out their eyeballs.
Oh, man. That's so creepy.
He cut them out using an X-Acto knife with surgical precision dumping their bodies out in plain sight where they were going to be for sure found. That's what he wanted to do, have somebody see his work.
Yep.
He was called several things in the media. He was called the Dallas Eyeball Killer. He was called the Dallas Slasher and the Dallas Ripper. But I think the Eyeball Killer's kind of stuck with him over the years. And his name was Charles Albright. Now, Charles Albright was born August 10th, 1933 in Amarillo and was adopted as a three-week-old by Dell and Fred Albright and brought back to Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Fred was a grocer and Dell had been a school teacher, but she quit, I guess, from what I understood, to be a homemaker and take care of Charles and be a, you know, a stay-at-home mom. From the get-go, as seems to be the case with a lot of these guys, Albright was a handful. He would regularly escape their yard at 3 years old and off. And she'd have to hunt him down and bring him home. And she couldn't figure out how he was getting out because she went all around the fence in the backyard trying to find some place he could get out. And there wasn't any.
Uh-oh.
She finally figured out, because I guess she watched him, she finally figured out he was stopping passersby and talking them into lifting him out over the fence out of the yard so he could run around outside.
Oh my God.
At 3 years old. So after that, she strapped him to the front porch like a dog on a stake.
Hey, I'm all about putting him on a leash. I know y'all think it's probably awful, but, you know, let's have that leash back.
Well, we had a little leash for just a little while with ours because, you know, she ran everywhere. Everywhere. Yeah. There was no place. She didn't walk. She ran. So,
you know what? It's just a little harness, not a dog collar, people. Yeah, come on. Exactly. Anyway, talking people into lifting him out of the yard, for goodness sake.
I know, right?
Oh, my God.
That shows you he was pretty charming from the beginning.
Oh, but yeah.
Dell was determined to do whatever was best for her boy.
Good mama.
She even kept goats in the backyard so he could have goat's milk because she'd read that goat's milk was better for kids than cow's milk.
Oh, my goodness.
She wouldn't let him get dirty.
Wow.
Even to the point that she'd change his clothes several times a day if he got a smudge on him.
Not pointing fingers here.
She was so afraid of him contracting polio, she told him not to touch dog poop because she thought that's where it came from. And she even went so far as to take him to a hospital with a polio ward. I think it was Parkland Hospital. And showed him the people in the iron lungs and told him he needed to be clean and careful or he'd end up there himself.
Oh, wow. She wanted to make an impression.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But her idea of raising Charles also had a kind of a dark side, even darker than taking him to the polio ward and changing his clothes all the time. Mm. When he was little, only a baby, about, he wasn't even a year old, she locked him in a dark room for chewing on her tape measure.
Oh.
That's what babies do. They chew on things,
well,
right?
Of course they do. Everything goes in their mouth. They don't know one way or the other.
Right.
Oh,
if
my
he
goodness.
Wouldn't take a nap, she would tie him down to his bed until he fell asleep.
Oh, my.
If he didn't drink his goat's milk when she wanted him to, she'd spank him. And I'm all about, you know, spank can't hurt some kids once in a while to startle them and make them know you mean business. But, you know, because he didn't drink his milk?
Mm.
Come on. When his aunt came to visit, his mom would often put him in dresses and hand him a doll to carry around the house.
Oh, here
like
we go.
Like he was a girl. And I think this kind of goes towards your nature versus nurture theory that you talk about from time to time.
I know it.
She kind of overdid the mom thing. And I thought I was bad about being overprotective. You know, she complains all the time about me being overprotective, but I didn't do anything like this lady did.
It's a different time now, too, so.
And then there was the fact that Dell was convinced Charles would be a genius, and she began to teach him at home as well as him attending school. Mm-hmm. So he ended up skipping a couple of grades and graduated high school at 15.
Oh.
But he was already getting into some trouble at an early age. He was arrested and convicted for assault at the age of 13.
Goodness.
Although I couldn't find any information about him being sent to reform school or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was extremely intelligent. He played piano very well because she made him practice 30 minutes a day. He spoke several languages.
Oh, wow.
He was a star athlete in high school and then in college playing football. And all this time, he really enjoyed stealing things. He was kicked out of University of North Texas here in Denton after stealing money from a cash register. He was 16 when he was arrested for theft, and the police found handguns and a rifle along with the money, like $300-something. Yeah. And he was sentenced to 2 years in prison, but he only spent 6 months in jail.
Wow.
After he was released, he traveled to Arkansas and enrolled in Arkansas Teachers College in Conway, where he met his future wife, Betty. But Charles didn't do that well academically, although he was extremely intelligent and picked up on things easily. But he was bored, and instead he liked to do the frat boy life, you know? He liked to have fun, and he liked to do parties, and he liked to pull pranks on his frat boy friends.
Oh, my.
When his roommate broke up with his girlfriend, instead of commiserating with him over a couple beers, he took the photographs of her that the friend had thrown out in the trash. He cut the eyes out of all the photographs and pasted them over pictures of his new girlfriend, the guy's new girlfriend, and taped
them
up on the walls, over his bed, next to his door, in the bathroom, and on the mirror. Everywhere he put his friend's ex-girlfriend's eyes up so he would see them.
That's creepy.
And the guys thought it was a little weird, but they thought it was kind of funny because, hey, that's Charles. It's a Charles prank. And they laughed it off.
Yeah. Ha ha ha. Ha ha.
Yeah. Exactly. Charles didn't finish college, Instead, he married Betty around Christmas of 1954 when he was 20 years old. Mm. And he let Betty make the living for them as with her job as a teacher while he worked a few odd jobs here and there.
Of course he did.
Never more than a few months at a time. He traveled to Mexico to try his hand at bullfighting.
Oh my God!
Evidently, he was pretty good at it. He was pretty good at everything he tried.
Well,
he,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
At one point, he became a hairstylist. He got his hands on a lathe and made baseball bats.
Holy schmoly.
He was a very, very good artist. So he got a job as an illustrator for a patent company and wow. another job as a designer for a company that built airplanes.
Love it.
He collected empty wine bottles from some of the upper class restaurants because he was going to someday open a winery. Basically, anything he wanted to try, he made sure he did it really well.
Well, hey.
Football, softball later in his life. He played on softball teams that went to tourneys in other states.
Wow.
And taxidermy.
You know, doesn't it always come back to mamas and taxidermy? Think about it now.
Well, his ever-doting mama, Dell, noticed that Charles had been shooting small animals with a gun he'd gotten as a gift.
Mm.
So she naturally thought, taxidermy.
Oh, she put him into that? Oh, my God.
She enlisted him in a mail-order taxidermy course at the age of 11 and even helped him skin the little critters. Could you believe it?
Oh, my gosh.
And in this taxidermy class, he learned how to scoop out the eyes so that they could be replaced with the marble eyes.
Oh, it's all coming mm-hmm. together now.
Mm-hmm. But his mama was frugal. You know, the woman didn't even buy herself a new dress. She bought everything secondhand at the Goodwill.
I'm cool with that.
Yeah. But, you know, she thought the eyeballs at the taxidermy place were too expensive, so she wouldn't buy him any. Instead, she took buttons from her sewing kit and sewed the buttons on for eyes for all these animals that he taxidermed.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. I mean, wow. This is a woman who was so, I think she passed frugal. She would go down to the butcher and ask for his dog bones so she could make soup out of them.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. You know.
I'm not there. No. I'm really, really frugal, but I'm not there.
You know, but Charles, he still wanted those marble eyes, even though he couldn't have them. He'd go down to the taxidermy place and he'd just sit there and run his hands through the bucket of marble eyes.
Oh, wow. This
to get his fix.
Oh, my. I'm just speechless. Go ahead. This is awesome. Oh, my God.
Uh-huh. So Charles kept getting into trouble for petty crime, stealing things. He stole some equipment from the Arkansas State Teachers College he attended in Conway, including the football coach's golf clubs. His own football coach, for crying out loud. He took his golf clubs.
Well, he's got some chutzpah, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. But he was expelled for that, although they didn't press any charges or anything like that. They didn't want to create a big stink because they liked him. Everybody liked him.
Yeah, he got kicked out of there. I'm thinking about the doctor in Dallas, Dr. Death, right? Kept mm-hmm. getting passed on. I'm thinking about Ed Gein, right? Mama, taxidermy, mail order taxidermy.
I'm thinking,
listen, y'all, this is where it happens. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So Charles continued to drift from job to job, letting Betty do the heavy lifting.
Oh, God.
And he was a charming guy around town. Everybody knew him. Everybody loved him. He was a good storyteller. He was generous with people. He would give them money if they needed. He would help them out. He would mow elderly people's lawns. He did all this stuff that endeared him to everybody around him. But in his spare time, he was still stealing things. Like he took a cart into a hardware store and loaded it up with a miter saw and some other things and just took it out the back door. And he became, during this time, a master forger.
Oh, my.
And, you know, he didn't do anything halfway. Right. So he became really good at it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He forged some papers he'd stolen back in the day from these colleges. And gave himself a bachelor's degree from East Texas State University and gave himself a master's in biology. And claimed he was enrolled in a PhD program at East Texas State.
Oh, my.
He changed his grades to make them all A's and B's,
and
making
not?
Himself look really good.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1968, at the age of 36, he took a job as a science teacher at a high school in Crandall, Texas, which is southeast of Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, he was good at anything he tried. The students loved him. He would take them out on field trips. They would do stuff outdoors, and they learned a lot with him as their teacher.
No doubt.
And he was a good-looking guy, so the teenage girls all mooned over him.
Uh-huh.
He helped coach the football team, but as was often the case for Charles, eventually somebody figured it out, right?
Of course.
The principal found out from an administrator at East Texas State that not only was Charles not in their PhD program, he didn't even graduate from the school. Not a bachelor's, not a master's, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
When he was confronted about those forged papers and those forged grades, he readily admitted it. He said, yeah, I did it. Because how else was I supposed to get a teaching job if I didn't have the credentials?
I may as well own it.
Yeah.
Own it.
And he's forged a teaching certificate, too. So,
oh, oh, my. Of course he did.
He was, of course, fired. And he was arrested for forging his documents, but only got probation for it.
Oh, my.
Because they figured it was a victimless crime, really. The kids had a good time. The football team had a good time. And, you know, everybody was happy.
Hey, they probably went to state and it's Texas. Yeah. And so it's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All bets are off.
You're a football coach in Texas. It's okay.
It don't matter what you did.
Especially if the team is good.
I'm telling you. And if you won, oh, my God.
Yeah, and they did, I guess, because I read one story where one of the students kicked a winning field goal or something like that, and he picked him up and carried him off the field celebrating and stuff like that. So, you know, I guess, yeah, he was pretty good at that too, evidently.
So, okay, good.
Another odd thing happened when he had a stint as a hairdresser. He loved ladies. He loved the women.
Oh my.
And he did an excellent job fixing their hair. And getting to know them, and everybody liked him, everybody loved him. Mm-hmm. Even the people he worked with thought he was a great guy. Mm-hmm. He would spend an hour with these ladies fixing their hair just right. And I think I said earlier he was a gifted artist.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd bragged about winning a competition at the state fair. And one of his fellow hairdressers asked him if he would paint a portrait of his wife, and he'd give him $250.
Wow, that's a lot of
money. That's a lot of
money
back in the
70s. Yeah, it is.
I think it's the 70s or 80s. Even, yeah. Either way, it was a lot
of money. A lot of money now.
To me, it is, yeah.
To me, yeah.
Anyway, he accepted it, and he started painting it, but he kept dragging his feet about getting it done, getting it finished. And the guy kept asking, you know, where's my painting? And he said, well, I've got this one more part that I just can't get right.
Mm.
And so one day the guy showed up at his house wanting to see what he'd done so far. He kind of figured he hadn't done anything and just taken his money.
Mm-hmm.
And what he saw was a 3x6 foot portrait of his wife. It was beautifully done. It looked just like her, except there were no eyes.
Uh-huh.
Just empty white spots of canvas where the eyes should be. The guy asked Charles when he was going to paint the eyes, and he told him something like, when I'm ready to. And a few weeks later, I guess he got ready to, and he finished the portrait, and the eyes were perfect. They matched the guy's wife's eyes so perfectly that it looked so real that they seemed to follow you around the room.
Oh, creepy.
The shading and everything was just right. It looked like an eyeball.
Creepy.
And that was a job well done, and the client was very pleased, but it was very creepy.
Yeah.
But he waited for the eyes.
Yeah.
Considering his obsession with eyes from a little kid.
Oh, yeah.
By 1975, Betty had finally had enough of making a living for the family, and she left him and took their daughter, which they'd had, after 20 years of marriage. They didn't divorce at that time. They didn't divorce until 1987. But in the meantime, he had girlfriends here and there, and when they would, he let them make his living for him while he did these odd jobs and ran around town and did new things, which I can admire. I like to do lots of new things. I like to do them well, if I can. And if I don't, I just don't do them anymore. But, you know, So I can admire that a little bit, but you know, you make a living for your family and yourself, right?
Well, at least you contribute.
Right. Charles was staying with friends in 1981 when he learned his beloved mother had died.
Dun, dun, dun.
And soon after, they accused him of molesting their 9-year-old daughter.
Oh, no.
He pleaded guilty, he claimed, to avoid further problems and hurt and everything for everybody involved.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yeah.
I get it. Yeah. Okay,
he went to trial. And once again, what'd he get?
Nothing. A slap on the wrist.
He got probation.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And then in 1986, his father, Fred, passed away, and Charles inherited nearly $100,000 because his dad was a grocer. He had been, and they had some rental property, and so they had saved up some money, and, you know, mom was cheap, so they'd saved up some money. And he'd been dating a woman by the name of Dixie Austin, and she promptly moved in with him and began making his living for him and paying all the bills, just like Betty.
Huh?
Oh my God. So we're going to take a break here for a word from our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to delve into the murders of the prostitutes, discuss the two police officers who discovered the connection, and talk about another suspect in the case.
Okay.
Right after this. Hey, Lark. I just got the best new earbuds. They're called Et from Studio.com. They're so comfortable and weatherproof.
Hey, I got a pair, too. They're my first earbuds, and they're fantastic. They come in their own little wireless charger case with a USB cord.
You can charge them anywhere and play them for up to 6 hours on a single charge. And I can use them with my iPhone, my laptop, or even my iPad Pro.
They're Bluetooth and noise-canceling, and the built-in mic is great for making phone calls.
And they're pink. I just love them. Did I mention they're pink?
They come in several colors, actually. Anyone can get them on Studio.com. Just use the code KUDZU for 15% off. KUDZU.
Thanks for coming back. So in 1990 in Dallas, it wasn't a great year for crime. As I said before, the homicide rates were way up. As a result, Dallas started to have something called storefront police patrols, and they connected all the small businesses in the seedier parts of town together, these officers did, with fax machines in case they saw someone suspicious snooping around, and they could contact the police and each other with these fax machines, because we didn't have a lot of the ease of, you know, the internet and things like that right at that point, because it hadn't been developed yet. And, you know, not everybody had a laptop or a desktop sitting around to just email somebody and call in the police, since it was such a high crime time in Dallas history, didn't get through very fast. So they had these fax machines.
Mm-hmm.
There were two partners, Officer John Matthews and Officer Regina Smith, and they were two of these storefront patrol officers in Oak Cliff, which is in South Dallas. Now, Oak Cliff was once a really nice kind of middle-class neighborhood area of suburb of Dallas, I guess you would call it. Their area of Dallas, with the little houses and the white picket fences and all of that kind of thing. But by the 1980s and 90s, it had become kind of a hole, and gang violence was bad and prostitution was rampant. These two officers patrolled that area all the time, every day, and they got to know the working girls.
Right.
Now, these weren't high-class hookers. They were women, mostly addicts, who charged 10 to $25 or $50 for a flatback, which is what they called basic sex or straight sex, with someone, anyone, so they could go to their next hit of crack. They have sex with anywhere from 10 to 20 men a day.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, they were human beings, and these two officers treated them like human beings. And in return, they would talk freely with them about stuff they were seeing and things that were happening.
Right.
So in December of 1990, the first victim was 33-year-old Mary Pratt, a known prostitute from the south side of Dallas, from Oak Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
She was quiet and didn't really want that life, but she needed to feed her drug habit. She was a good person, evidently, from what I could find out, and she lived with her parents still in Lancaster. And each night, she'd get one of her clients to drive her home to her parents' house in Lancaster, and she'd spent, you know, go to her old bedroom that she lived in when she was a kid. She still lived there. And say goodnight to her elderly parents who had no clue what she was doing to make money. But the police knew Mary, and she worked out of the Star Motel in Oak Cliff, which was basically a prostitute hotel, or they called them whore hotels or something like that. There were a lot of them in Oak Cliff. But in this December, she was found posed near the street. Her legs were splayed, wearing only a t-shirt and her bra, which were pushed up above her breasts. She'd been beaten and shot once in the back of the head. Detective John Westfallen and his partner, Detective Stan McNear, got the case. They knew that sometimes these ladies had problems with guys who would jump bad. They called it, the prostitutes called it jumped. He jumped bad on me, meaning that they got mean and they started knocking them around and punching them and stuff like that.
Okay.
But they'd never seen anything like this before. And it was, you know, they didn't murder them. They just smack them around a bit because that's what they got off on, you know.
Right, right.
And it was obvious that she had been murdered somewhere else and dumped where she was found because there was no evidence around her to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those prostitutes were busy 10 to 20 a day. So just about anybody in Dallas could have been the one that killed her, right?
Right. And they weren't watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they sent her on to the medical examiner's office, and Dr. Elizabeth Peacock did the usual examination, beating, check, track marks from her drug use, check, bullet hole in her head, check, eye color. When Dr. Peacock went to lift Mary's eyelids, there were no eyeballs. They'd been very precisely cut out, not even a little tiny nick or anything around the eyelids or around the eyes.
Wow. Oh, my God.
And they, whoever did it had just lifted them out expertly, just scooped them out of the eye socket. And she said the optic nerve is really tough, so they really had to know what they were doing and be able to do it without damaging anything around the area of the eyes. They just did it, and they closed their eyelids, and you couldn't tell there wasn't an eyeball in there until you opened the eyelid.
Wow. Creepy!
Yeah. That was an unusual calling card. Westfallen was sure he could go back to the office and check the databases and find somebody who was a suspect. You know, something had to have been recorded. This was so weird, this eyeball thing, but nothing came up. Punched out, gouged out, mashed out, yeah, but not surgically removed. He couldn't find anything. And they thought for a minute that a doctor might have been involved, but Dr. Peacock said that's not even something that they teach you in medical school to do, remove an eyeball like that. Because there's like six bundles of muscle tissue around your eyeball and then the optic nerve, you know, in the back, sort of the side back that you got to cut out. And she said they don't train you for that, to do that. So they didn't release that little detail, the cops didn't, to the public. They kept it to themselves in case somebody, you know, during interrogation popped out with that information and they would know that they didn't release it, you know, like they
do. Exactly, yeah.
But they were still working on the case. They hadn't found anybody a couple of months later in February when another prostitute, 27-year-old Susan Peterson, was found alongside the same road as Mary Pratt. She'd been shot in the chest, abdomen, and the top of her head, and she was again posed and again dumped, not where she was killed. Okay. They kind of, she didn't want to be a prostitute, Susan, but I'm sure nobody figures that's going to be their life's work.
Exactly.
And she had even gone into the military in the Navy out of high school. She was an ensign in the Navy.
Aww.
I couldn't find any information about what happened other than, like the rest of them, she was an addict and this helped her pay for her drug habit. But she was also pretty strong and kind of street savvy, they thought. And she knew how to fight back. She'd done it before. And they knew she would fight back if she needed to. So someone must have surprised her and she hadn't seen it coming. Somebody that she trusted. So when her body arrived at the medical examiner's office, once again, I mean, she'd been beaten up pretty badly. Bruises everywhere. Aww. Like she had fought back. And once again, they found that her eyeballs had been removed. And that's when they knew they had a serial killer on their hands.
Yeah.
And even though they wanted to keep as many of the details out of the press as they could, they kind of felt like they needed to warn the girls on the street that somebody was out to get them.
Yeah, that's the right thing to do.
Yeah. And of course, someone in Homicide leaked to the press about the eyeballs, and all hell broke loose, and everybody was on the, you know, all the reporters were storming for more information. But by this time, you know, those officers who worked the storefront I told you about, Matthews and Smith.
Right.
They knew Susan personally. They talked to her on several occasions, you know, as they made their rounds. And so this made it kind of personal for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they kind of started working the case on their own, on the side, without really getting permission or telling the homicide detectives they were doing it. But they had access to the girls. Well, and so they went and started talking to the girls, you know, and told them to be careful and told them if anything weird happened to let them know. And asked around if they knew anybody who liked eyeballs.
So, yeah, yeah. Anybody got a weirdo fetish?
And then in March, remember the last one was, first one was December. The second one was February. Now it's March. And so he's escalating. Right. Like they do.
Right.
A third woman was found. The first two had been white. So the black girls on the street weren't too worried about it. This girl, Shirley Williams, was black. And she was found kind of. It looked like the job had been a little hurried this time, like he was about to get caught and he rushed it. The eyeball job wasn't quite as neat. She wasn't found posed quite like the others. She was found kind of thrown out along a curb like he was in a hurry.
Yeah.
And there was an unused condom dropped near her body.
Okay.
And they kind of think, you know, the Westfall got the word that there was another body, and he told the medical, the coroner that got there, lift up her eyelids and tell me if she's got eyes. And she didn't. So they were pretty sure it was the same guy. You know, he just got interrupted with his routine. Now, Matthews and Smith went back to the prostitutes after this happened and found one in particular who described something that had just recently happened to her. Her name was Brenda White. She was another black prostitute. And she said that she picked up a guy, or the guy picked her up, and he wanted to go to a specific place where he liked to go. And she said no, because she never let anyone take her anywhere other than one of the whore motels.
Gotcha.
And so she told him to stop and let her out. And when she did, he changed from nice as he could be to evil. She said his eyes changed. He just got this evil look on his face, and he told her he hated whores, and he was going to kill them all.
Wow.
And then she described him to the officers. He had salt and pepper hair, and he had a slightly stocky kind of athletic build. Now, at first, they thought back to one of the other girls who'd told them of an assault, and they'd seen her with a trucker named Axton Schindler. This guy drove a truck. They decided to check him out. Even though the girl said it wasn't him that assaulted her, he had been the one who rescued her. They decided to check him out anyway, just to see if she was lying because she was scared or something.
Right.
So they went to the Dallas constable's office, and they were still a little bit wary of telling the detectives they were doing all this stuff behind their backs, but they knew these girls and they wanted to help solve this case, like I said.
Yeah.
And they talked to the deputy constable on duty and talked him into checking on Schindler. They had an address for him for one of the girls. I'm not sure how. It turned out the address they had wasn't where Schindler lived. It was where his landlord, Fred Albright, lived.
Oh.
And then they saw that Fred was deceased. And the deputy constable recognized the name Albright and said, I wonder if this has to do with Charles Albright. And if they'd gotten any other constable, they wouldn't have gotten that answer, but he had gotten a call from one of Mary Pratt's, the first prostitute who died. One of her friends called the constable's office and told them that Mary and Charles had dated. And that Charles had a strange obsession with eyes. And that he kept X-Acto knives in his attic. And I guess the police didn't take it seriously at the time, but now.
Yep, here we are.
So they looked up Charles and they found a picture of the guy with salt and pepper hair and an athletic, stocky build, which fit White's description to a T of the guy who assaulted her or tried to assault her. So then at this point, Matthews and Smith knew they had to take this information to the homicide detectives. And they went and they spoke with Westfallen. Now, Westfallen was known as a tenacious guy, and he would get a confession out of anybody because he just didn't let it go. But
I love it.
He looked at what they had, and he kind of thought they might be right. So he had a photo lineup made up of six guys, including Charles, mm-hmm. and had them take it to Brenda White. Without hesitation, she pointed to Charles, and she said, "That's the guy." And so did the other prostitute who'd been assaulted.
Wow. Good job, girls.
And that was enough to get a search warrant for Charles's house. There, they found X-Acto blades. They found those red condoms that I told you about that were found by Shirley's body.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of true crime books and books about serial killings.
Uh-oh.
And they brought Charles in for questioning. They knew he was strong enough to wrestle with these girls and strangle them and get a stranglehold on them and kill them. He'd been a football player and he wasn't a small guy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He had to know how to remove eyes neatly because, remember, taxidermy lessons.
Exactly.
He learned how to scoop out eyeballs of those animals and how he liked to run his hands through the eyeballs at the supply store.
All I can think of, I have to say, is, you know, haunted houses with grapes and olive oil over them.
Well, he just, he That's liked so to do terrible. That. And, apparently. You know, he waited to paint his friend's wife's eyes until the very last because he felt exactly. like he needed to get them just right.
Uh-huh.
And this little tidbit that I didn't tell you yet. Uh-huh. He had a paper route that put him on the streets of Oak Cliff between 1 and 4 in the morning when the murders took place.
What
and he
cover.
Frequented these girls. They knew him. He brought, he was nice. He brought them presents and things like that. Mm. He sometimes liked a little kink with his flat back.
Uh-huh.
And one time he hired two girls at a time, tied them up and yelled at them and beat them with a belt and threatened them.
Oh, here we go.
Now, most of the evidence they had was circumstantial. Hairs and fibers identified as his on the girls. You know, they didn't have the DNA testing like they have now at the time that they could do on hairs and get like a profile of sorts. But hairs matching his were found on Shirley's raincoat, and hairs matching Shirley were found in the trunk of his car. And evidently it was enough for the jury, because on December 19th, 1991, Charles Albright was convicted of the murder of Shirley Williams. Not the other two, because there wasn't as much circumstantial evidence. Now, he still maintains he was innocent.
Of course he does.
He's 87 years old now. He still maintains he was innocent, like they all do. But the murder stopped. Once they got him off the street, he spent some time in a psych hospital where the doctors said that he could lie so convincingly, he could convince himself that his lies were the truth.
Well, isn't that the way he's lying? So, I mean, people that lie, they convince themselves that it's true.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, he'd convinced himself his biological mother had been a prostitute, even though he'd met her after Dell died and knew she was a nurse in Wichita Falls.
Oh, my.
He hated prostitutes. And he told his softball teammate he hated prostitutes because his mother was a prostitute. So
I wonder, well, go on.
Go ahead.
Questions. I have questions. Well, I wonder, do you think he read, you know, too much true crime? You know what I mean? You know, and that's what put that in his mind, maybe, that it was, he needed to be some sort of vigilante. And I hate prostitutes because his mother wasn't a prostitute necessarily. She was just a.
She was a nurse. His biological mother was a nurse in Wichita Falls.
Right.
But he had made her out to be a prostitute, and he'd convinced himself she was a prostitute, and he told his softball teammate that she was a prostitute because they'd made fun of him. A car had driven by with some ladies in it, and they kind of all figured it was prostitutes looking for some guys, you know. And so one of them hollered at him and said, "Hey, Charles, there you go. Go get them." And it made him mad. It really made him angry. It's the only time that his softball teammates ever saw him angry. Usually he was always the nice guy. He'd give people presents. You know, he'd give the prostitutes presents. He'd give his girlfriends presents. But he got really angry at that. And that's what he told them, that he didn't take prostitution lightly because his mother was a prostitute, his biological mother. So,
well, do you think his adopted mom ever told him stuff like that?
No, actually, she told him that his mother was a brilliant law school student and she couldn't have a child at the time because she was trying to get through law school and pass the bar. That's what she told him.
Well, that
was his mother.
Kind of her to
it,
say.
It actually really that. Was kind of her to say. I mean, there's not anything wrong with being a nurse. I think she did that more to convince him that he was brilliant. You know?
Right. But also, I mean, instead of going down the road of your mom was, you know,
a prostitute,
a dirty, nasty whore, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? She's kind of saying, hey, you know, she
the
wasn't
truth
bad,
is she probably didn't even know what she was or who she was.
Right.
because right. they adopted him from at 3 weeks old from an orphanage.
Right.
So, you know, he met his, like I said, he met his mother after Dell died, and she was a nurse in Wichita Falls. And so he knew better. But he'd probably over the years made his mind up that this was the case. When he was 15 years old, he got crabs from a prostitute. He'd visited prostitutes his whole life.
And
so that probably pissed him off right there. And he hated prostitutes from then on. It didn't stop him from visiting them, though.
Okay, okay, okay. Because I have another question. I don't know if you might have discovered this or not. So, okay, so what was he doing with the eyeballs? Did they ever find the eyeballs?
They never found the eyeballs.
You think
his defense attorney tried to get him off with was they never found the eyeballs. They didn't have the hard evidence. They only had circumstantial evidence. But
all right, so the ghoul in me is going to ask the ghoul in Kim, you think he ate them?
I don't know what he did with them, honestly. There were all kinds of hidey holes in that house he lived in.
Right.
They found a hidey hole and found guns and a rifle and things like that in it that he'd probably stolen because he liked to do that.
Well, sure.
But they never found those eyeballs, and he could have fed them to the cats for all we know.
Well, yeah, that will be the first thing they eat off me if I died alone. Which I'm not going to, by the way. Yeah. So there. Kim has had this we've both had this bet for years that the cats are going to eat my eyeballs first.
You have 20 of them, Lark. if you count the outside ones.
Technically, they're going to eat my nose and my ears first.
Probably
just
the softer tissue. Yeah, they'll probably go for that first.
So you know, and then they'll have to dig deeper, I guess, later down the road. But I'm not. Yeah,
they usually
there.
Get the lips and all of that kind of stuff, the really soft, hangy off kind of things.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I won't really care at that point.
Well, hopefully that won't happen.
So he got convicted. Did he die yet? Dead yet?
No, he's 87 years old. He's the last I could find. He was incarcerated at John Montford Psychiatric Unit in Lubbock, Texas. So he's alive and kicking. The last I could find about him.
So they pushed him as far to the edge of the state of Texas as they could
get him. Out of Dallas, as far as
you
can.
You go into the border, boy.
the only place they could have gone farther is El Paso.
Exactly. I know it. We're going to put you as far away as possible.
Yep.
Oh, yep. My God. Well, wow. That is so creepy. I mean, you know, eyes mean so many things to so many people, and it's just... It's just weird.
I never could find out why the eyes, because of course he still won't admit that he did it, but he obviously had an obsession with eyes. This Schindler guy didn't have any reason to do it. He didn't have a criminal history. He'd
right.
never been to see these prostitutes. None of them knew who he was. He did
right.
rescue the one girl from someone who was beating her up. We don't know for sure if that was Charles or not, because he ran off before the trial started. I figure he was pretty scared, probably, that he was living in a house that might have been used, for all he knew, when he was away to kill these girls.
Right, right.
So, you know, but yeah, this guy had a clear obsession with eyes. He clearly hated prostitutes. So, you know. I'm sure he did it. There are also folks out there who are trying to say he's innocent. I saw some psychology paperwork from some groups, you know, where they give you in psychology class, they give you somebody to do a profile on or to research and give your idea if they were really guilty or if they were wrongfully convicted. And of course, these girls found out that they decided he was wrongfully convicted, but I don't think so.
Can I just say?
You know, I mean, he frequented the prostitutes. He knew these girls who were murdered. He was the bail bond contact for one of them. And, you know, he ran his fingers through eyeballs. He liked eyeballs. He wouldn't paint eyeballs until he was ready to paint eyeballs. And yeah, he did it. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I just say, police? Yeah. Police. Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, oh, that's really interesting. Those are the ones that really, really kind of fascinate me, because it does go a little bit deeper than I just hate you, I'm going to kill you, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know.
Who knows? I mean, when he was
If those two storefront police officers had not known that second victim,
mm-hmm.
and had not known that the other girl, Miss White, Brenda White, had been assaulted, he could have killed no telling how many more. They wouldn't have caught him right there.
Or, you know, so. What? Or being so personally involved, because you know what? I think a lot more police are that personally involved, but, you know, good for these two, really.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad they did their little investigation on the side, because if they hadn't, you know, who knows how many he would have killed before he was caught.
Well, you know,
if he ever got caught, because this guy was really good at convincing people he was just the best person there was.
Right, right. And, you know, it just shows that the cops see these girls and everybody, no matter what, as
humans. They're human beings, and they see
and they weren't being
way.
Judgmental, or right. you know, they weren't putting them at the bottom of the bucket. You know, they saw what these girls were doing and why they had to do it, and they were still protecting them and worried about mm-hmm. them even after they were dead. So
exactly,
yeah.
I mean,
that's a true calling for a police officer and a public servant. I think
so too. You really have to care about the people you're working for. If you don't, what's the point? You need to have that empathy.
Yeah, so
them.
I mean that always it does touch me that people that are really wanting to take care of people, normal people, are really mixing it up with probably the worst situations and sometimes the worst people, you know?
Yeah.
But but there's good story, Kim.
There's a lot more detailed information out there. There's a story about him in Texas Monthly by Skip Hollinsworth, who's a fantastic true crime writer. There are lots and lots of interviews. TLC did a show on him. Oxygen did a show on him. And there was just so much out there about him. I could not include it all. He was just, he's such an interesting person. Really.
Hey, is there a picture of that portrait that he painted?
No, I would love that. I couldn't find one.
Dang.
I looked for it.
Dang, that's what I want. I want a picture.
I looked for it and I couldn't find it, but maybe I'll find it. And if I do, I'll post it up on our blog. But
you know, I'm not hip to serial killer art. That's not my jam. Okay. But
he wasn't a serial killer that we knew of at this point in time. So
no, and I would just be curious to see, you know, what his art looks like. I mean, but anyway, I would not to purchase or nothing. I'm just curious what it looked like.
Yeah, I'm sure they don't want to show it because I'm sure the wife doesn't want anybody to.
Oh, that's true. We need to protect people's privacy and stuff like that. But
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was a really, really interesting story. And there I was, oblivious and enjoying my life to the max at that time.
And, well, that's what you do when you're in your 20s, but, you know.
Well, yeah. And, you know, as a matter of fact, probably right before that, I was living around Oak Cliff at that time in some little houses with two friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And you know what? Just on a side note, as I'm thinking about it, these houses were little. They're like those tiny little cottages, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was taking a shower. Everybody's gone. I was taking a shower and I came out and I remember realizing that somebody had been in the back door.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like what happened to me in Memphis, you know?
Yeah.
While I was taking a shower, because they'd already broken into my house, mm-hmm. right? You were there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the guy that broke in and went through my underwear and peed on my bed, that guy.
Yes, yes.
Well, I was taking a shower the next day or the day after. They tried to get in again. They tried to crowbar. I had those wrought iron doors. I don't know if you remember them. All those big, fancy, scrolly wrought iron doors on my back door and my front door. And they had taken a crowbar to my back door and tried to open it up while I was in the shower.
Yep. I know. It's scary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you just, looking back, we've dodged lots of bullets. We might tell y'all about those.
One day, we'll
make a compilation of our dodged bullets, because there's been a few.
Yes, there has.
Across many states, like him. We could drag y'all across. Let's see, Mississippi, Louisiana.
Yeah, we've got
Tennessee. Texas. Okay, well, anyway, back to the real story. But well, thanks.
That was the story, and, you know, go out and read about this guy, really. He's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Usually are. I mean, and you know what? They're usually brilliant. I wonder if their minds just can't get enough
stimulation.
You know, stimulation. Mm-hmm. And then they get fixated on one thing and go down that hole, you know?
Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. So, yay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The bomb diggity, man. Thank you.
And we will see you guys on Friday.
We love your stories, Kim.
This one was really, I liked this one. Sick as it is, I liked doing this one.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, we'll see you guys Friday for Forensic Friday. Bye, y'all.
Thanks again for sticking with us. Bye.
That's our episode for this week. Thanks for listening to us, and we hope you join us again every Tuesday for an exciting new episode.
Head on over to our blog at kudzukillerspodcast.blogspot.com and leave a comment or your ideas about the subject this week.
Or follow us on Twitter at kudzukillerspod, and you can shout out to us anytime or send a question for our next Q&A.
Yes, ma'am. And we'd love you forever if you leave us a review on whatever podcast blows you scared at. We'd love to hear what you think about your show.
If you'd like to become a part of the Kudzu Killers family, hop on over to patreon.com/kudzukillerspodcast and take a look at the goodies you get when you show us some love.
That's right. And if you love our music, check out Jody Jennings Music on Facebook, SoundCloud, or all social media and streaming music platforms.
So until next week,
or if we decide to shoot out a mini episode,
bye y'all.
Bye, y'all.